Welcome to the Hardball Times Audio, your weekly stop for baseball's biggest stories, past and present, with your hosts, Jen MacRamos, Sarah Wexler, and Mary Craig. On Sunday night, the Cubs defeated the Nationals on a walk-off, but this was no ordinary walk-off. It was about as dramatic a walk-off as possible. Behind 3-0 with the bases loaded and down to the game's final strike, David Bote hit a grand slam to give the Cubs the win.
Sorry, it's Bodie.
Bodie. Damn it. So what happens when I haven't been watching baseball in a while? It's been a long week. Anyway, David Bodie hit a grand slam to give the Cubs the win. What are some of our favorite super dramatic, almost too good to be true baseball moments?
I would like to submit the 2004 ALCS for consideration, particularly games 4 and 5. They were basically as dramatic as you can get. And they were also a lot of baseball to have watched, given that they were both well over 4.5 hours long. But they turned out great for me, so it was worth it.
Congratulations, Jimmy Fallon in Fever Pitch.
Oh, don't bring him up.
Hey, that's a great movie, even if Jimmy's kind of jumped the shark.
That's true.
I'll stand by that.
I agree.
I did like all of the Fenway shots.
Yeah, yeah. No, that was cool how they managed to pull all that off. As for my personal favorite super dramatic moment, it was also a walk-off grand slam. It was Steve Finley's in 2004 to beat the Giants to clinch the NL West. And that was just one of those moments that was kind of like, oh my God, how is this really happening? And I was actually there in person, and it was just like one of the most electric settings I've ever experienced in a baseball stadium. That was a good memory.
So mine would have to be, this is a very random one, and I think it's only extremely memorable for me because it created my username through most of like the end of high school and early college. So it was 2008. It was the Angels at A's. Francisco Rodriguez was on the mound. And Cliff Pennington was at the plate. Cliff Pennington hits a Baltimore chop down by one. And he chops it well over the mound. K-Rod tries to field it, and he throws it into the bullpen. And Jack Hanahan scores. And there's someone else who scored, and then Jack Hanahan scored the winning run, and then, like, everyone just kind of died because K-Rod blew the game. Not only did he blew the game, but he also threw the ball into the bullpen, which would have prevented that from happening. And for me, it was just the fact that it was a Baltimore chop. Yeah. Especially since, like, the Baltimore chop hasn't really been, like, used as much in modern baseball. So it was just really cool to see that kind of old-timey baseball move used for a walk-off. And I used to know the entire call of the play, but it's been 10 years. But
I love that sense of dread that everybody gets as soon as one of their pitchers goes to field a ball. And you're like, is it going to make it to first or is it going to go into the stands?
I mean, especially since it was Francisco Rodriguez and he was already a wild pitcher. So you're like, oh my God, no, don't field the ball. And then, of course, he has to field the ball. And that just ended up in flames for them.
I do love the range, I guess, in dramatic moments. It's like, yeah, people can hit walk-off home runs, and that's exciting. But also people can hit Baltimore chops, and that can be a total game changer. It's like there's no shortage of ways to be super dramatic in this game.
Do you guys consider a walk-off balk to be dramatic, like in and of itself, or is it just because it wins the game?
It's a good question. It's, I feel like it's a different kind of dramatic. Like, it's not necessarily like movie cinematic dramatic. But I mean, it's kind of one of those moments that sort of takes your breath away, certainly. Like, what? How did that happen? How do you possibly balk in this situation? Like, the absolute worst possible situation to balk in. But yeah, balks always kind of shock me because, I don't know, it seems like something that is avoidable. But I'm also really bad at telling when balks happen, if I'm being completely honest. So.
Yeah, balks are just very hard to figure out, period. And then, like, you don't know when it's going to happen. But I feel like it's on the same kind of dramatic level of unexpectedness because you're like, wait, that was a balk? Wait, they won? It's more of, like, the surprise of, like, wait, that happened? Not
and,
like
nobody has any idea what's going on.
And it's not
they're
like,
all like, huh?
It's not like, oh, my God, a walk-off grand slam in the last possible strike. It's just a different kind of surprise.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I probably wouldn't qualify that as, like, I mean, maybe if it was, like, Game 7 of the World Series or something. Like, you could see it as being, like, the twist ending of, you know, some baseball movie. But, yeah, overall, I don't think I would think that is kind of in the same ballpark, so to speak, as these other things.
Speaking of weird things happening in the ballpark, after beating the Orioles 16-5 on Wednesday, I brought my A game today. The Mets scored a franchise record 24 runs against Philly in the first game of a doubleheader on Thursday. But the highlight of the game just might belong to Scott Kingery, who came into the game in a relief in the eighth inning and threw a pitch so slow the MLB radar gun could not pick it up. So how do these two games and how does this number of runs scored factor into the Mets being the Mets?
It's extremely Metsy. Extremely, extremely Metsy because it's like, They don't have an offense on paper that should be producing this amount of runs. They don't have an offense that should be even producing half the number of runs. The whole team should not be this productive, and yet they are. And of course it comes in the middle of August when their playoff hopes are already dead. So yeah, it is just the most Mets thing to ever Mets this season, and they have some pretty Metsy things.
Yeah, there's something, I guess, ironic about a team that, you know, is so very, very hapless turning around and doing something like this. And it's just a reminder that even the worst baseball team is still a team full of professionals, and they can hit, and they will sometimes run into a pitcher having an off day or a team having an off day, as it were. And you end up with things like this. So it's not, you know, it seems like it's something that shouldn't happen to the Mets, and yet it definitely is something that would happen to the Mets.
Yeah, that's very true. And I think it just kind of adds to the fact of the Metsness of the whole situation that they cannot buy a run for their likely Cy Young winning pitcher. And yet here they just, like, explode for runs. So, poor DeGrom.
Yeah, it's very cruel.
So, for the second part of this whole situation, is there any pitcher or position player we would think it would be even more hilarious to throw a slower pitch than Kingery did in this game?
I'm just reminded of how, he's not a position player, but at the Cal League All-Star game, Tommy Evald just went for his outing and then randomly threw a very, very slow knuckleball for the hell of it. And I would like to see a position player do something like that in Major League Baseball. I want to say Yasiel Puig just goes up there, throws like a 30-mile-an-hour knuckleball to throw everyone off.
Yeah, everyone's expecting a position player pitching appearance for Yasiel Puig and him just come out throwing complete heat. But it would be very Puig-esque to go up there and just totally flout everyone's expectations.
I think it would be also really great if Mike Trout did it, just because I think people would kind of expect Trout to kind of come out onto the mound and just dominate, because that's what we're used to from Trout. And, like, of course, he would also be a good pitcher because it's Mike Trout. So I think that would just be hilarious.
I think it would also be interesting if it were Buster Posey, because he has not pitched in 10 years. And the last time he pitched was, I believe, a super regional against Stanford, and he gave up 10 runs.
Ooh.
There's a reason he was not drafted as a pitcher.
Well, it's good he had another set of skills then.
He was not even drafted as a shortstop, and that was his primary position at Florida State, so.
I mean, sometimes things get it right.
Yeah. But there's, like, for a while, people were like, well, will Buster Posey be the one who pitches in a game for the Giants if they need a position player? And everyone's like, God, no, please don't let it be Posey. Let it be Belt. But I would like to see Buster Posey pitch once in a major league game. Just one pitch. Just that slow knuckleball going over home plate.
Like, everybody should just get a Rizzo, or they just come in for one batter and then they're like, never again, I'm done. Like, this was really worse than I thought it would be.
Every position player should have that chance.
Yeah, and, you know, get all the sights, their clicks that they're after. It's a good deal for everybody. I'm going to submit Chris Davis, and I'm talking Chris with a K Davis, but, you know, other Chris Davis would probably do the job too. But yeah, Chris Davis is kind of known for not having a great arm. So I think it would be fun to see him trying to take his stuff to the mound. Just cause, you know, it's always fun to watch guys who are really good at what they do. And in his case, that's hitting dingers, try to do something else and not do so well at it. So yeah, I think he would fit this pretty well.
Yeah, that's a good choice.
So, during Tuesday's Dodgers-Giants game, a brawl broke out when catcher Nick Hundley apparently said something that Yasiel Puig took exception to. Evidently, Hundley didn't care for the way Puig had been expressing frustration over missing pitches. In the ensuing fracas, Puig slapped Hundley on the mask. Both he and Hundley were ejected from the game. Side note here, I was at this game, and I, you know, it's one of those things where you're watching from the stands and you don't really know what's going on. You just see, like, all of a sudden, oh, these guys are going at each other. What's the deal? And then so you're, like, at the game, and of course they're not going to show you the replay, so you have to, like, go to Twitter and be like, oh, there's a gif of Puig slapping Hundley in the mask. Getting back on track, though, punishments were subsequently handed down, but only Puig was suspended, getting 2 games for his role in the altercation. Both players, however, were fined. Are these punishments fair, given Puig and Hundley's roles in the brawl?
No. I think Hundley should have been suspended and Puig not suspended. Also, I think that players need to stop going after Puig, especially white players. Like, I'm just so tired of Puig being the one targeted for a lot of stuff. And I know I've said on this podcast multiple times, I'm a Giants fan, but I do not care for their disrespect of Puig.
Yeah, it just seems really ridiculous that Puig was the only one suspended when it was actually Hundley that instigated Puig and started the fight. So, like, if Hundley hadn't have opened his mouth, then there would have been no fight. So that just seems bizarre that Major League Baseball totally neglected that part of the entire altercation. And I agree with Jen, it's just kind of ridiculous that the Giants are still, particularly white Giants players, are still going after Puig. It's just incredibly petty and stupid and racist, and they need to stop. And also, on a lighter note, I would like to give a shout out to Andrew McCutchen's recap of this that he posted, and Twitter kind of picked up. It's absolutely hilarious. And if anybody hasn't watched it, you need to seek it out, because it's amazing.
I need to do that. It's been
You haven't seen it yet?
I have not. It's been a long week at work. But I will do that immediately following this podcast.
Okay. Actually, we should, if it would be, I'm trying to decide if it'd be great listening or terrible listening to like have you watch it and react to it in real time on the
We can
podcast.
try it out and then just cut it out if it's terrible.
Could do that, yeah.
Well, I honestly think I don't mind that Puig got suspended necessarily because yeah, he's the one who kind of made it physical, but I do mind that he was the only one suspended. I think it's garbage that Hundley can just get away with, intentionally provoking him and get nothing but a fine. So yeah, it's not the fact that Puig was suspended that bothers me as much as the fact that it wasn't an equitable punishment. So that's kind of frustrating.
Also, I would very much like for players to not hit catcher's masks with their hands. That's incredibly dangerous.
Yes, at least he had the sense to not like make a fist and punch, because that
That's
would
true.
have resulted in several broken fingers probably. Like it was just a little slap. Like I'm sure that probably didn't hurt too much, even though it's Puig's giant hands, so maybe that has a bit more force than the average human, but
That wasn't the only brawl this week. Ah, baseball. The Marlins and the Braves got into it on Wednesday when Jose Ureña very clearly intentionally hit Ronald Acuña Jr. on the wrist to open the game. Acuña was in the midst of a five straight. Acuña was in the midst of a streak of five games with a home run and three straight games with a leadoff home run, two of which came against the Marlins. Ureña received a six-game suspension, which effectively amounts to one start. This also sets up his next start to come against the Braves. How should MLB respond to malicious intentional plunkings?
There just has to be a more hefty penalty than missing one start, because that's clearly not enough to stop it from happening. In addition to kind of increasing the punishment, there just needs to be a concerted effort on behalf of Major League Baseball to change the entire culture of baseball, where players no longer, particularly pitchers, no longer find it offensive for players to hit well against them, because that is not the fault of the players. Maybe pitch better and this wouldn't happen to you.
Yeah, exactly. It's got to be both a change in culture and a more serious consequence. One game, especially for a team like the Marlins that's so far out of it, isn't really going to send a message of any kind. So that's obviously not, yeah, that's something that's got to be adjusted going forward. To me, that the Braves broadcast team once again managed to look kind of silly in the midst of all this, even though it was their team that was the one that was wronged. I believe the comment was something to the effect of, "Oh, Acuna didn't even do anything to show them up, like flip his bat." And it's like, who cares if he had? Like, that doesn't make it okay to hit the dude in the wrist. And, fortunately, he was okay. He, was in the lineup the next day, but it's still really dangerous. You're like playing with fire with a dude's career, or at least, his rookie season.
Yeah, I just feel that it's like, God, it's so, like, that kind of punitive attitude just, like, does not belong in baseball. And I get that Acuña is extremely talented, but that does not deserve a plunking on the wrist. Like, there's just so many things that I just want baseball to stop, and intentional plunkings is one of them because it is the dumbest thing that a pitcher can do.
Yeah, and it's just such an uneven retribution, like giving up a home run versus hitting a guy. Like, that's just two very different things. One has, such a relatively marginal impact, whereas the other one can seriously injure people. So it just seems like that is also just really, really terrible on behalf of the pitcher to think that that is something worth hitting people over. Well, with the Blue Jays in Kansas City to face the Royals this week, Curtis Granderson leading Blue Jays.
Sorry, let's try that's that my again. Bad.
No, I should have got that. With the Blue Jays in Kansas City to face the Royals this week, Curtis Granderson led the Blue Jays on a tour of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. According to an article by Ben Nicholson-Smith of Sportsnet, Granderson was inspired to take his teammates to the museum when Kevin Pillar revealed that he didn't know who Larry Doby was. On the subject of Negro League Baseball and its place in history, Granderson said, quote, "As we start talking about gender equality issues in 2018, they had women owners. They had women players. Not only that, they had teams playing against international countries, such as Japan, first before Major League Baseball did. Things we're still grappling with today, they were doing it. They were doing what we're still trying to do to this day. So, visiting the NLBM should be required of major leaguers, correct?"
I think the way that Granderson put it, with regards to his personal tour that he ended up taking about half of his team on, was, it's not mandatory, but I'd highly encourage it. And I think that's, I know I've talked on this podcast before, that was probably quite a while back, about how I think that it would be really useful for baseball players to have some sort of education in baseball history. I think it would help with a lot of things. And Negro League history is very much a part of that. So I understand that it's not necessarily all that feasible for people to get to Kansas City necessarily. But I think there's something to be said for maybe a remote program, if that's something that the Negro League Museum would be interested in helping put together, that could help educate ball players, and maybe not even exclusively ball players, but it could be certainly used by them to learn about the Negro League sort of in crash course form. I think that would be a great tool, and it would help players to sort of have a better understanding of the context in which they're playing now, as well as the history of the game. So, yeah, maybe not necessarily a requirement, but I think it would greatly benefit baseball and baseball players if they sort of had a better understanding of elements of the game's past that maybe they weren't exposed to before.
Yeah, I don't think that it should be mandatory, because sometimes mandatory learning doesn't get through to everyone. But I think it should be highly encouraged, especially whenever a team does go into Kansas City to play the Royals, especially like every AL team should have that option to go to the Negro Leagues Museum. And, you know, it could be like a team organized thing. It could be a team building thing. It could be, you know, talked about how like this is something that's really important, and it's very encouraged that players go along with it, but not necessarily required.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think it's a huge failing of Major League Baseball that there are Major League players like Kevin Pillar who have no idea who Larry Doby is, or you know, a variety of other pioneering black baseball players. So I think that Major League Baseball, as you guys were saying, needs to do more to integrate the history of Major League Baseball, particularly when it comes to marginalized communities, into the general you know, landscape of baseball today, and to make sure that both players and fans understand this history and how it pertains to the game as it exists today.
The Women's Baseball World Cup begins this upcoming Wednesday, August 22nd. We are very lucky today to be joined by an infielder for the U.S. Women's National Baseball Team and a student athlete for Arizona State University, Jade Gortares. Jade, how are you today?
I'm doing pretty good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. So in addition to playing for the U.S. Women's National Team, you also play softball at ASU. Can you tell us a bit about your athletic journey and what it's like for you switching between softball and baseball?
Yeah, I pretty much started playing baseball when I was about 3 years old, and I just really played up until my senior year in high school, just always played baseball. Didn't really make the switch, not too much into softball. I played a few tournaments here and there just to get looked at by colleges, but I had opportunities to play baseball in college as well, but I chose the softball route. So ever since then, I'm just playing softball at ASU and also playing baseball with the national team.
Cool. So that's interesting. I think we hear a lot about people who maybe start baseball young, but then maybe transition to softball because they don't necessarily have the option to play baseball past a certain point. But it's cool that you actually had those opportunities. Who would you say are some of the women who have been your baseball inspirations?
I mean, growing up and whatnot, there just really wasn't a route going into like women's baseball. And I didn't find out about the national team till I was maybe 14. But so I wouldn't say I had a huge inspiration or a role model or whatnot, but some of my teammates actually inspire me just to be a better leader and a better player all the way around. Like Malaika Underwood and Tamara Holmes are just two influences that I've had ever since I've been working
with them. Is there any advice you would give to young girls who play baseball but would likely make the switch to softball due to lack of baseball options?
I mean, I would say just keep playing baseball for as long as possible. If you're good enough, they're just going to let you keep playing and they'll find a spot for you. If you happen to go the softball route early, then it's not a bad decision either, just because of the endless opportunities for girls in that sport. But if you can play baseball, I would highly recommend it just for different fundamentals. And you learn, I believe that I've learned more of the game going the baseball route rather than softball.
So people often think that softball is just kind of the women's version of baseball. Can you talk us through some of the main differences between the two sports?
I would say, well, the super technical aspects of it is softball is bigger than baseball. Baseball has bigger bats. Softball is thinner bats, like different angles and launch angles and all that other stuff that hitting coaches like to talk about more of now. But I would say just the game in general is very different. With baseball, you have more time really to develop a certain type of play. And in softball, it's kind of like you're being rushed and whatnot. So that's why I think, going back to the last question, that's why I believe that baseball is just a better route to learn more of the game and more options and possibilities that you can do. It's baseball really allows you to test your limits more than softball does.
That's interesting. So this is your second time competing in the Women's Baseball World Cup. In 2014, you and Team USA finished second in the tournament. How was that experience for you, and what did you take away from it for this year's tournament?
This is actually my third time with the cup team, but in 2014, I was maybe 15 and a half, 16, so I was really young. I was the youngest kid on the team, I remember. And so just being around all the women and whatnot on this squad and the squad from back then, it's just, I kind of learned I had to grow up like really fast, especially being in a different country halfway across the world in Japan. But I would take away just a whole new level of maturity ever since I joined the national team, and just the endless thoughts and mind workings of different players and whatnot. So I like to pick people's brains most of the time, getting it from whether it be our coaches or, like I said, older players.
Do you expect anything to be particularly different about the tournament this time?
I mean, I'm just really excited, especially about this team. We had our first game yesterday, and we were just taking our pregame, and it probably was one of the cleanest ones that I've, since I've been on this team, that we've had. It was just our defensive caliber and just the hitting that we have. It's going to be exciting, this World Cup.
Seeing the action this time around. So what do you think that the future holds for women's baseball in the United States?
I think it's getting better every single year, especially when we begin our tryouts and trials processes. Every time that we have a national open, we just see new talent, younger talent. That reminds me of just 4 years ago. Like, I was the same age as most of these younger girls that come out. And some of them are doing really well. Like, we picked up two very young girls on our team, Ashton Lansdell and Emily Tsujikawa, and they're just good talent to have. And just having them on this team, they just really see what it's going to take, and they could take it away for the next World Cup that comes or future tournaments that come, and just go back to those other younger players that they play with or are their friends and whatnot. And they can just go back to them and say, like, hey, this is what you got to do, and this is how it works to make the team. I'm just really excited to have those two with us this World Cup, and just excited for the future.
Yeah, and that just reminds me of how there's the Trailblazer series every year, especially with a lot of the women's national team roster being coaches there. I bet they see a lot of young women with a lot of talent there coming through, especially since it's a national thing.
Yeah, I agree. It's just every time the coaches go out there and they host that event, they always just telling all the vets that, hey, there's good talent coming. So, like, make sure you stay on top of your game and get ready.
Yeah, that's really, really great to hear and see. The action for U.S. Women's National Team continues this Wednesday when they face Puerto Rico. Jade, best of luck in the tournament, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you, guys.
And now for another installment of This Week in Baseball History. On August 19th, 1921, Ty Cobb records his 3,000th career hit. At 34 years old, Cobb still holds the record as the youngest ever to the mark. He's also the youngest ever to the 1,000, 2,000, and 4,000 hit marks.
On August 21st, 1947, the inaugural Little League World Series takes place in Williamsport.
August 19th, 1951, Browns owner Bill Veeck pulls off his most famous stunt.
It's pronounced Beck.
Beck. As in wreck.
Yeah.
I am not good with names this week.
To be fair, I mean, they're it's only tricky the names. Like weird like European names. So
yeah. Like it should be weak. There are two E's even.
Yeah, I guess it's like Dutch or something.
Yeah.
Let the record show, Jen cannot pronounce European names at all. Give me a complicated
just
name
white people with nonsense.
All right, August 19th, 1951, Browns owner Bill Veeck pulls off his most famous stunt, signing dwarf Eddie Goodell. I see.
Yeah, again, European nonsense.
Well, we should put like for all the names that are like not exactly as they are spelled, we should like add pronunciation guides.
Yeah, that's a good idea going forward.
Signing dwarf Eddie Goodell to a contract and having him pinch hit, donning the number 1/8. Goodell, of course, drew a walk.
He had a lot of interesting stunts during his career. Yes. Crazy guy. He had a lot of innovation, but like just weird stuff like this.
I'd say he made the game better overall, definitely. And I really admire that he wasn't afraid to take risks. But I guess maybe using a little person to be a publicity stunt maybe wasn't his shining hour, even if it's his most famous moments. We've talked some about brawls this week. Here's another one. On August 22nd, 1965, one of baseball's most infamous brawls occurs as Giants pitcher Juan Marichal at bat against Sandy Koufax takes exception to catcher Johnny Roseboro's return throws coming too close to his head and attacks Roseboro with his bat. The brawl lasts for 14 minutes before it can be broken up. Willie Mays, a good friend of Roseboro's, tended to the catcher's wounds. Roseboro and Marichal later ended up becoming friends, and Marichal even served as pallbearer and speaker at Roseboro's funeral in 2002.
What a heartwarming story.
If those guys can work it out, anyone can.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, like you look at the world's problems today. Oh, no. Like just use these guys as a blueprint. Then on August 19th, 1992, Brett Boone makes his major league debut, making him the first third-generation MLB player. His father, Bob, and his grandfather, Ray, were also major leaguers. It's quite the list of simple names in their family.
Ray, Bob, and Brett.
At least there's Aaron. It's two syllables. They tried to change it up.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Hardball Times audio / Jen cannot pronounce European names. You can find the Hardball Times at fangraphs.com/THT and on Twitter at @Hardball_Times. I can be found on Twitter at Jen Mac Ramos. You can find Sarah at Sarah Wexler 32. You can find Mary at Mary M. Craig. And you can find the podcast on Twitter at THT audio. Thanks to our theme music from bensound.com. You can find all the episodes of the Hardball Times audio on fangraphs.com/THT/THT-audio and iTunes. Please rate and subscribe. Be sure to tune in next week for another episode.